which meant she kept ordering different cleaning supplies and kept yelling at different exterminators on the phone. Each new arrival promised eradication in hours. Each orange jug with its skull and crossbones promised death. Zoe labeled spray bottles with masking tape, specifying where they were to be used. Espresso. Bar sink 1. Bar sink 2. Zoe modified side work checklists, ordered special rags to clean out the ice machine, special blue strips of paper that we had to wear gloves to handle and hang in the fruit fly area. What Zoe didn't do was get rid of the bugs. I learned that every single restaurant in New York City had bugs, from uptown to downtown. I still would have eaten off the ground in the kitchen. The place was spotless. Part of our job was to protect the ignorance of the guests, who couldn't handle the hard truths of the city. We said, "It's just winter. It's just the park. It's just construction down the block. It's the neighbors." All of that was true. And yet, when Will found a prehistoric-looking cockroach popsicle, even I gagged. It was exquisitely frozen inside an ice cube. He had scooped it from the ice bin. We passed it around until it started to melt, our mouths open in wonder. To that we said, "Fucking disgusting." I did my part. I initialed Zoe's checklist that hung on clipboards above the stations. But one day, I went to hang my apron on a hook, and it dropped into a crack behind the freezer. When I looked down for it, the wall was covered. Covered. Families. Generations of roaches breeding, feeding, dying, in the temperate exhaust from the freezer. I stopped fighting so hard. We were outnumbered. "Au sang!" Simone exclaimed as she came into the kitchen. I kept doing my job, eyes down, scraping spent candles out of the votives. Somebody hadn't put enough water in them. They stuck to the sides even as I hacked away at them. I couldn't remember. It might have been me. "What?" I asked, just in case she was talking to me. Our chats had tapered off lately. "Chef, il sont magnifique," she murmured. The two of them leaned over a crate, rapped at whatever golden object was in there. It grated on me when she slipped into French with Chef or Howard or Jake. She would drop her voice, so I heard only the curl of a romance language and knew I was being left out. I had apologized to her about the opus again. I confessed to Howard a day later, and he had already forgotten about it. I had no choice but to wait her out until she directed her attention back at me. When she looked at me, like I was as exciting as whatever was in the crate. "At pre-shift," Chef said, "tonight we have plat de fruit de mer. Very traditional. Oysters, mussels, cherry stone clams, prawns, head on, and the small snails. But what takes it over the top is some spanking fresh uni in the shell." Someone whistled, a few groans of desire. 17 orders. This is a hand sell, people. We're not printing it. $175 per tower. "Per tower?" I yelled out. Everyone looked at me. Howard continued. "'Tis the season, my friends. People are celebrating. They have been waiting to dine with us. You are here because you're perceptive, so read your tables. See if this is what will make them rave about our restaurant. And do what you will, of course, but I highly recommend some champagne, or perhaps a Chablis as an alternative." I followed her upstairs to the locker room, where she was digging through clean aprons with an obsessive tenacity to find the shorter one she preferred. I was forcing a thaw, I knew it, but I was tired of waiting. "Okay, so tell me." "Tell you what?" "The uni." "Excuse me?" I mean, please tell me about the uni. Uni is sea urchin roe crowning the tower this evening. But why is it special? I motioned with my hands for her to get on with it. You're getting a bit spoiled, aren't you? No. I stood up straighter. I don't like having to beg for information. Are you upset with me or something? Don't be dramatic. Shouldn't you be focusing on your work? I'm trying to. She hitched a new apron high onto her waist, making her look momentarily maternal, pastoral. She remarked her lips with her lipstick. I saw sprays of silver in her coarse hair. I saw inscriptions of her years around her mouth, a solid crease between her brows from a lifetime of cynicism. The posture of a woman who had stood in a casual spotlight in every room she'd ever been in, not for gloss or perfection, for self-possession. Everything she touched, she added an apostrophe to. It's quite eerie, she said, inspecting her face, pulling up her cheeks. When you begin to see your mother in the mirror. I won't know, I said. No, you won't. You will always look like a stranger to yourself. She never dealt in pity. I didn't know what to say. Your mother must be pretty, I said eventually. You're pretty. You think so? She looked at me from the mirror, unimpressed. Why don't you want a boyfriend? I had made two assumptions before I knew what was happening. First, that she didn't have a boyfriend. Second, that it was because she didn't want one. A boyfriend? That's a sweet word. I'm afraid I am in retirement from love, little one. She barely, but definitely softened. In Marseille, you could walk down to the docks in the mornings. They had urchins, still alive. An offhand exchange, a few francs for this delicacy. The rocks are littered with debris. Empty shells opened with a knife, rinsed by salt water, and sucked dry on the spot. Men taking lunch with bottles of their hard house wine, watching the boats move in and out. It's the ovaries. The coral ovaries. They are supposed to transfer great power when you consume them. Absolutely voluptuous. The texture. Absolutely permanent. The taste. It stays with you for the rest of your life. She went toward the door, pulling her hair back. She looked at me thoughtfully. There are so many things to be blasé about. Your youth, your health, your employment. But real food, gifts from the ocean, no less, is not one of them. It's one of the only things that can immerse you safely in pleasure in this degraded, miserable place. It's exhausting, Howard said as he put on a slate wool overcoat, a fedora, and leather gloves. He looked like he'd walked in from the 1940s. He gazed toward the exit and smiled at me. You really have to love it. Yes, I said. I swirled the milk and splashed it on the espresso. I knew exactly how to make his macchiatos. It's like physically tiring, but there is something else that really flattens me every night. I can't put my finger on it. Entropy, he said, like I was the sixth person to ask him. He raised his eyebrows at me to see if I knew what it meant, and I raised my eyebrows back to say I was skeptical of his usage. Rather, it's a case of mismatched desires. The restaurant, an entity separate from us, but composed of us, has a set of desires, which we call service. What is service? It's exhausting. It's order. Service is a structure that controls chaos. But the guests, The servers have desires as well. Unfortunately, we want to disrupt that order. We produce chaos through our randomness, through our unpredictability. Now, he sipped, and I nodded that I was still with him. We are humans, aren't we? You are, I am. But we are also the restaurant. So we are in constant correction. We are always straining to retain control. But can you control entropy? No. No? We just try. And yes, it is tiring. I saw the restaurant as a ruin. I imagined the owner closing the place, locking the door many decades from now, and the dust and the fruit flies and the grease accumulating. No one working around the clock to clean the dishes and linens. The restaurant returning to its primitive, non-functional elements. Thank you, he said, and put the cup down. You're a free man now? That I am. I have some manly Christmas decorating to do. I nodded. It had surprised me, the holiday erupting in the park, in Flower Girl's ridiculous bar arrangement. It was hung with actual cookies from the pastry department. Even Clem's had strung up lights. I remembered how warm New York had looked in Christmas movies. How benevolent and rich the shop windows were. How everyone's humanity broke through just in time for redemption. Just in time for faith. It didn't feel like that when I walked to work. It felt cold and forced. I guess I should go see that tree or something. Will you be around for the holidays? He asked. I thought, you scheduled me the day before and the day after. Where the fuck do you think I'm going to go? But I said, yeah, I'm here. Just relaxing. I hear it's very quiet. Well, if you find yourself restless, I host an orphan's Christmas every year. Don't worry. Simone does most of the cooking. I wouldn't subject anyone to mine. But it's a tradition. You are heartily invited. And it's not as boring as I've made it sound. Are you an orphan? Ah, he smiled at me. We are all orphans eventually. That's if we're lucky. He waved to someone at the bar who had spotted him and winked at me before releasing himself from our grip and into the free fall of the evening. Wait until the truffles hit the dining room? Absolute sex, said Scott. When the truffles arrived, the paintings leaned off the walls toward them. They were the grand trumpets of winter, heralding excess against the poverty of the landscape. The black ones came first, and the cooks packed them up in plastic quart containers with arborio rice to keep them dry. They promised to make us risotto with the infused rice once the truffles were gone. The white ones came later, looking like galactic fungus. They immediately went into the safe in Chef's office. In a safe? Really? The trouble we take is in direct proportion to the trouble they take. They are impossible, Simone said under her breath while Chef went over the specials. They can't be that impossible if they are on restaurant menus all over town. I caught her eye. I'm kidding. You can't cultivate them. The farmers used to take female pigs out into the countryside, lead them to the oaks, and pray. They don't use pigs anymore. They use well-behaved dogs, but they still walk and hope. What happened to the female pigs? Simone smiled. The scent smells like testosterone to them. It drives them wild. They destroyed the land and the truffles because they would get so frenzied. I waited at the service bar for drinks, and Sasha came up beside me with a small wooden box. He opened it, and there sat the blanched, malignant-looking tuber and a small razor designed specifically for it. The scent infiltrated every corner of the room, heady as opium smoke, drowsing us. Nikki picked up the truffle in his bare hand and delivered it to Bar 11. He shaved it from high above the guest's plate. Freshly tilled earth, fields of manure, the forest floor after a rain. I smelled berries, upheaval, mold, sheets sweated through 1,000 times. Absolute sex. That was why it took me some time to see the snow falling in the window at the end of the bar. Whispers rose among the guests. They pointed to the street. Their heads turned in a reverent row. Thin shards of truffle drifted down and disappeared into the tagliatelle. "Finally," said Nikki, and replaced the truffle. He leaned back on the bar, wearing a handsome, self-satisfied smile. "You never forget your first snow in New York." The first flakes lingered in the window, framed. For a second, I believed they would fly back up to the streetlights. I came to love the Williamsburg Bridge, once I learned how to walk it. I was mostly alone. A few all-weather bikers, a few heavily bundled Hasidic women. I walked either in some dusky circumference of gray light or some blotchy, cottoned afternoon. It never failed to move me. I paused in the middle of the filthy river. I stared at the trash eddying in currents and clinging to docks like wine dregs cling to a glass. Simone had mentioned the orphans' dinner at Howard's to me. I thought of them all up there at Howard's on the Upper West Side. I thought of Jake in a Christmas sweater. I told them I was busy. "Remember this," I told myself. "Remember how quiet today is." I had the newspaper, which I would keep for years, and I was on my way to lunch in Chinatown by myself. As I contemplated the skyline, this double feeling came to me as one thought, pressing in from either side of the bridge. Impossible for me to reconcile. It is ludicrous for anyone to live here. And I can never leave. 4. Sometimes I saw all of service condensed, as if I had only worked one night that stretched out over the months. I kicked the kitchen doors open with the toe of my clog. I came up the stairs, and Jake and I met eyes. I looped the dining room in sweeping, elongated arcs, both my biceps and wrists tense. I saw myself without a time lapse, the images still and laid on top of each other. All the plates of filet mignon of tuna streamlined into its essential form, the filet mignon of tuna. Lapidary. All the napkins I ever folded in a totemic monument. And running through these still lifes, an unmistakable straight line, was the gaze with which I watched them. A gaze in which sometimes Jake or Simone would join me. That's all I remembered. These few images, and watching them all from afar. A huge stillness. A giant pause. When I felt like this, it was the easiest and most beautiful job in the world. But I knew it was never still, that it was always flawed and straying from the ideal. To romanticize it was to lie. I heard it turn midnight from the wine room. A beckoning din came through the ceiling, thumping on the floorboards, whistling. I ran up the stairs, and there was a crowd at the service bar, where flutes were lined up. The regulars had left their stools to cheer with us. Simone brought me a glass of the Cuvée Elizabeth Salmon Rosé Champagne. I shut my eyes. Peaches, almonds, marzipan, rose petals, a whiff of gunpowder, and I had started a new year in New York City. You, in a dress. That's what I wanted him to say. He didn't end up saying it, but I said it to myself many times as I greeted my reflection in the buildings going up Broadway. My high heels rocked me like roller skates. My hair that I had spent time blow-drying was whipped up. I was suddenly vulnerable to the weather, to uneven sidewalks. I nodded to the iron wedge of the Flatiron like a prestigious acquaintance. The dress was half a paycheck. A short black silk tunic. I was still confused about the power of clothes. Nobody had taught me how to dress myself. When I tried it on and looked in the mirror, I was meeting myself decades from now, when I had grown unconquerable. All in a dress. I nearly returned it twice. I saw myself in the dark green glass of a closed bank. I turned to my reflection. You. In a dress. The owner closed the restaurant on New Year's Day. He rented out a bar, and we all got to drink there with one giant, miraculous, unending tab. From the stories everyone had been rehashing, bad behavior abounded. Someone was going to get too drunk, and though Will and Ariel were both betting on me, I was determined to stay on the soberer side of wasted, and had brought my own bag of coke to ensure it. I had forgotten that there would be adults there. The owner and his wife stood at the entrance, beaming down authority and warmth. Even they must have been hungover, but they were flawless. A small line had formed to greet them, and as he shook each person's hand, his eyes didn't scan the room. His wife looked charitable and flashed a smile that drew you out of the ground. I tiptoed around the line. I couldn't say hello. What if he didn't remember me? What if I started crying? I remembered orientation, and I still couldn't believe that they had chosen me. It went more or less according to plan. Baby blinis with caviar, foie gras crostini, broiled mussels in the shell, crab dip, oyster shooters. Decadent and finger-sized from the owner's new catering company. We greeted each other tentatively, checking each other out, marveling at the transformations of dress-up. Ariel in a miniskirt and a sweater she had cut into a crop. Will in a lavender button-down. Sasha in all black and sunglasses. We clung to the bar nervously, trying to get a little tipsy, suddenly scared to talk to these strangers. An hour into it, the entire room relaxed, and laughter rang out coarsely from all over the room, and the DJ turned up the music. Then the superlative started. Of course I had voted. Zoe made sure we all voted when she passed out the ballots at pre-shift. There were some usual suspects. Prettiest eyes, cutest couple. And there were the industry-specific prizes, most likely to start a restaurant. I figured it was another code I had to break. Every category had a natural winner. Starting a restaurant? It had to be Nicky. He talked about ditching us and opening up his own bar all the time. Person you want to wait on your mom was Heather, because she looked and talked like a doll. As they announced the prizes, I was the shallow spectator I had been in the beginning. Biggest prankster was Parker. I had put Nicky for that one as well because I wasn't sure Parker even knew how to speak. Apparently, he had been pranking the people he liked for years. I had yet to fall into that category. Most likely to make it to Broadway was Ariel. She stuck her finger in her throat and retched. Will went and got the award for her. Then Howard, in a top hat no less, said, "And the person you'd most like to be stuck in an elevator with is Tess." A polite smattering of applause and a wolf whistle. I clapped too. Everyone stared at me. It dripped into my head, from some neglected faucet, thickly, painfully, that I was Tess. I had chosen Simone after a thorough consideration. "This is your elevator person," I told myself. "It's not the person you made plans with. It's not where you thought you'd end up, but bam, the elevator sticks. Your life, a luscious pause, dictated by chance. All the tasks of the day are tossed away. You can't know when you'll make it out, but unlike the desert island scenario, with the elevator, you can be assured of an eventual exit. Of course, I thought about Jake. There he was, all to myself. I thought of him pinning the four corners of me to the wall with his body. But the flaming center of my fantasy wasn't the sex. No, what I wanted to get to was after. We would still be trapped in the elevator. He would look at me. There would be no bar tickets, no crowds, no phone calls, no stripes. He would be forced to recognize me. I knew that if I could get him to see me, then both of us would stop being lonely. But then I reconsidered. Chances are Jake would be in a mood. I had a sense of how he would react to feeling trapped. What if he fell silent? What if he was mean? Or worse, what if I bored him? The nakedness of the scenario scared me. So he was off my list. With Simone, the mood in the elevator went from erotic to cerebral, and I was relieved. Simone would recite Wordsworth, William Blake, or, if I was feeling modern, Wallace Stevens, Frank O'Hara. Simone would explain how wines were made in the Jura in the 1800s and how it related to the cheeses. She would remember details of paintings she saw in Florence a decade ago, and the name of the trattoria where she took lunch afterward. She might even tell me a story about their salt-strewn, dune-grass-covered childhood. I would make fun of myself and make her laugh. I would tell her stories of demented middle America, and how after I first read Catcher in the Rye when I was 10 years old, I packed a backpack and ran away from home, but returned after neighbors found me sleeping in their tool shed. Simone would unravel the universe and tell me why it was so hard to find meaning in our technological age, why cities rise and fall, why we are doomed only to repeat ourselves. And after all this prolonged contact, I would come away changed. With more of her on me, the lessons would be permanent. "Tess!" Howard waved a generic certificate that one of the hostesses had decorated with gold stars. I stood up uneasily in my heels. I turned to look for someone, turned to look for someone, turned to look for someone. I said thank you and took my seat again. But not before I gave my coworkers a real once-over. I tried to meet as many eyes as possible and ask them, "Me? So, did you vote for me or what?" I slid myself down the bar to him, simmering, lacy, high. In my shoes, I was closer to his eyeline. Jake in a muted, worn-out flannel and wool slacks, his hair flat and gracie, uncomfortable, hunched. "I hate these things. Every year I say, never again." "What's to hate? Free appetizers." I looked around the room at the strange group of people who had been chosen by the restaurant. The clicks came magnetically back together after the initial shocks of being out of context. The porters and dishwashers were wearing sports coats, and they sat with their heavily made-up, animated wives. The cooks had taken over a corner of the bar, where they sipped on añejo tequila and paused for shots of mezcal. The floor around them was wet from spillage. The hostesses and the pastry girls hovered around them like a protective layer of atmosphere. The real grown-ups were at a table together. Howard had brought an age-appropriate date who did everything at half speed. She chewed each bite to completion before setting her fork down, reaching into her lap, and pressing her napkin to her lips lightly, not enough to disrupt her lipstick. Definitely not a restaurant person. There was Chef and his rather beautiful wife. There was Nikki and Denise, who had her cell phone out on the table. It flashed with updates from the babysitter. Simone had joined the table to talk to Denise, their knees turned toward each other. I thought about them in their 20s. Denise with no kids, just dating a bartender. Simone lighter, more prone to laughter. Parker and Sasha played quarters at our table. Ariel and Will were probably in the bathroom. And Heather was trying to get Santos to dance. It was so predictable and lovely. My heart struggled to hold it. As if I don't see enough of these people, he said darkly. And to be here on my day off? Giant waste of time. Why did you come? It's not worth the black mark for non-participation. Besides, he shot back his whiskey and nodded to the bartender for another. Free drinks. Misha, the hostess we all still made fun of for her inflated breasts, walked by and stuck her arm out to me. Tess, congrats, the big win! She giggled. I looked at my certificate. I had carried it over with me in case I wanted to brag to Jake. But next to him, it looked childish. So embarrassing, actually, I said. I folded up the award. I nodded to the bartender. A white, not too oaky, please. No Chardonnay. You earned it, he said, taking another drink and looking away from me. It's kind of nice, right? I said. People want to spend time with me. They aren't trying to ditch me in diners. I'm not so terribly annoying. When he turned to me, his eyes were jagged, slivered, and I was scared. I thought he must be on something. He said, "That's the biggest whore award. You know that, right?" Whore? Come on, new girl, don't play dumb. Your kitchen boys always send it out to whoever they want to fuck. But, oh yeah, congrats, the big win. I tried to laugh, but it died in my throat. Scott saw me from the end of the bar and winked. After so much crying, and bathrooms sitting on toilets, hiding next to the air conditioner in the pastry station, behind the ice machine, into my pillow, into my hands, sometimes simply into my locker. This time, I didn't flee. I stayed, and the tears came. You. It wouldn't come to me. The vicious words I longed for were lost in the flotsam of being humiliated, yet again, like always. You are mean, Jake. It's too mean for me. His eyes flashed blue and then collapsed. I'm sorry, he said. Tess. I nodded. Please excuse me. As I walked, I forced my heels into the ground. My wine glass burned in my hand. Simone's eyes brushed over me and went to the bar. Yes, I thought. Go to him. Comfort him, because the new girl with the biggest whore award called him mean. Tess? I picked my feet up off the bathroom floor to hide from her, but I had just taken a line and sniffled. She knocked on the stall. You can only come in if you do drugs. Drugs only zone. I clicked it open. She came in. We were uncomfortably close. We could have stood by the sinks, but she locked the door behind her and sat on the toilet. She gave me her open palm, and I put my bag in it. She poured a tiny bump out on the webbing between her pointer finger and her thumb. She inhaled it without taking her eyes off me. Please, she said in response to my expression. I was young once. She touched the end of her nose thoughtfully, and I touched mine. I thought it was a good thing, I said. My hands were shaking. I really thought, oh, here I am, stuck in an elevator. I better pick someone I picked you. I'm flattered. I pressed toilet paper to my cheeks. It's like we're exchanging, going back and forth, just playing. And then he hits me too hard. It goes from play pain to real pain. I know. Simone, am I not doing this right? Everything feels like a punishment. What are you being punished for? I don't fucking know. Being stupid? Stop it. She grabbed my hands unsympathetically. No one is interested in you playing the victim. Get out of your head. If you don't, you'll always be disappointed. Pay attention. I pulled my hands away and she folded hers into her lap. Is it too late? She asked. For what? For you to let this flirtation go. I think it's more than a flirtation, Simone. It's not. It's a fantasy. Jake knows it, and you know it. Can you let it go? She looked at me impassively. Okay, I mean, we work together, so... I paused. What do you mean Jake knows it? I mean that Jake is aware of this crush. You guys talk about me? I thought I might vomit. We don't talk about you. It has come up. It? I thought we were friends. Am I just this big fucking joke to you? You're getting carried away. The way she said it was so matter-of-fact that I nodded. Now, can you let it go? Fuck them, I thought. I'm going to quit. Then I saw that Simone was right. I wasn't a victim. I hadn't been led anywhere. I had chosen this overgrown, murky path where I couldn't see 5 feet in front of me. The drugs, the drinking until black, the embarrassment, the confusion. But really, I had chosen the two of them. They were the difficult terrain. I understood what she meant by let it go. I didn't have to quit my job. There had been another route open to me this entire time. A well-lit, well-laid, honest path. I said to myself, turn around. You do not have to take every experience on the pulse. It's just dinner. I saw the silent elevator. Just me. Another voice said, but then, you'll just be a back waiter. I can't, I said. Let it go. I mean, I don't want to. She exhaled, frustrated with me. Don't you remember what it's like? She held her face as if it were made of granite. I saw a flicker. Aqueous. Vulnerable. No, I don't, she said. I don't remember, and I don't care to. You must have felt like this before. Are you really made of stone like they say? I don't think you are, Simone. I see your heart. I pointed to her chest, but she looked furious. All right, Tess. You want it all? You don't care about consequences. Then it is too late. I could tell you to leave him alone, that he's complicated, not in a sexy way, but in a damaged way. I could tell you damage isn't sexy. It's scary. You're still young enough to think every experience will improve you in some long-term way, but it isn't true. How do you suppose damage gets passed on? There was heat coming off her, and I felt the drugs. My blood ran like lighter fluid through my veins. You sound a little bitter. Bitter. She pulled the word through a clenched jaw. She pulled back her shoulders like she was on the floor, readjusting, and said, "We shall see. I'll speak to him." "Don't," I said. Will's warning came back to me faintly, about trusting Simone. I had already made myself her pupil, but I had an incision of fear about handing this over to her. Did Jake really need Simone's blessing? Is that what had been missing this entire time? If those were the terms, then I accepted. Didn't I? Or, I don't know, do whatever you want. It's not even a big deal. Little one, it is a big deal. You forget how important he is to me. I'm obviously quite invested in you, too. I know. I looked at our feet and dragged my shoe back and forth across the tile. I had a dream about you, part of a dream. It was that we had a secret. You were my mother, and you let me show up late for work, and you came to my apartment and made my bed. But you told me that no one else would understand, and if I told, I would be punished. Odd. That was all she said. I don't think you're old enough to be my mother. That's not what I meant by dreaming that. You should pass that along to Howard. He's very good with dreams. Should have been an analyst in another life. She stood and did a small backbend, stretching, cracking. I wouldn't mind being in an elevator with you. Roomier than a bathroom stall. She handed me a piece of toilet paper. No more crying at work. I wanted to ask her if that was love. The blindness, the careening falls, the invisible slow dancing, the longing for real pain, the fixedness. I wouldn't have gotten an answer. She never spoke to me about love from personal experience. Love was a theory, something that had been embalmed. Love will do X to you if you let it, or love is a necessary condition to Y, or Y is a particular brand of love you will encounter in places like Z. Perhaps that's why she was so untouched. She didn't remember. She never got down on her knees on the asphalt like the rest of us. She couldn't tell me about the unspeakably real stuff. What I learned came from the ground up. He yanked on my wrist and pulled me back from the group I was leaving with. Will made a face that said, "Coming?" And I held up my hand to say, "One minute." "Text me," Will yelled as the elevator doors closed in front of his face. I turned to Jake. "What? Simone told you to apologize?" He stared at the carpet, pensive. "Pathetic," I said. I pressed the button. I was sorry as soon as I said it. "You're wearing me out, honestly." I pressed the button again and again. I saw that alternative route, path of peace, of light. I saw the bar, the beer, and the gentleness of being with friends. All of that obliterated when he came near me. I had given him permission to do that. A bell rang and the doors parted. Jake went into the back corner and I stood in front of him, holding the door as everyone crowded in. "Going out for one, Denise?" I asked Nikki's wife. Nikki told me that she was the first woman who ever talked back to him, and he knew immediately he had to marry her. She was a sharp brunette, still pretty, but her cheeks were gaunt now. "No, no. We are heading home. Our best-case scenario is a 5 a.m. wake-up with the wee one."
"Best case."
Nikki clapped and turned toward me. "Fluff doesn't get home till 5 a.m., isn't that right?" "What's Fluff?" asked Denise. "It's an old nickname," I said, and my breath shot out of me. Jake dragged his finger down my back. "From high school." My spine a burning candlestick, everywhere he touched dripping.
"Behind you."
"I did vote for you," he said softly so only I heard it. And we were back at it, the night buoyant, time elastic, my body forgiving. "Denise," I said, stepping back closer to him. "Remind me, how old is the youngest?" I straddled him in the back seat of a taxi, leather seats groaning, his fingers inside me, pumping, pressing into a white-hot spot in my stomach. I was struck through layers of intoxication that I might come suddenly. He shifted his thumb, and I recoiled, sure I wouldn't come at all. A passage of pushing and pulling, my hair, strands of it coming out in his hand, his shirt collar, him holding me down, forcing me harder onto his lap. The cab hit a pothole, and I exhaled. When I climbed on top of him, I momentarily thought of the taxi driver. How far into his shift was he? I wanted to tell him, I work long nights too. Sometimes people treat me terribly. I imagine the taxi driver had a small daughter who called him while he worked. He put her voice on speakerphone and it lit up the car. A glamour shot of his wife hung off the rearview mirror. I assumed it was his wife. She had her hand behind her ear and her head tilted, holding a rose in the other hand. Her lipstick matched the flower. I wondered if the money was good New Year's Day. I wondered if he had seen everything. He slammed the partition shut and turned up the music. And Jake pulled up my skirt, and I forgot the taxi driver was a person. I was gnawing on his lips, his ears, his chin, trying to extend the tremor in my stomach. "I'm close," I wanted to say, colored lights smudging the windows. "It's very close." Jake grabbed my face and said, "Do you know what you taste like?" And pulled his fingers out of me and jammed them into my mouth. I didn't gag. I was too stunned to feel anything at first. "I'm salty," I thought. "I don't taste bad." But I moaned. I ground into him harder. I was completely turned on, switched on. Not by my taste, but by Jake's certainty. There were so few moments I had been certain in my life. I was constant revision, constant doubt. What I learned, as he slipped his fingers out of my mouth and back inside me, is that in New York City, there are absolutely no rules. I didn't understand that monstrous freedom until Jake said into my mouth, "Come for me." And I came in the back of a cab. There were people who did whatever the fuck they wanted, and their city was terrifying, barbaric, and breathless. 5.
Some men take to vinegar with relish. They delight in the sparkling traces of fermentation. His fingers in the pickles, in the sour cherries we imported from Italy and spooned into Manhattans. His olive juice-soaked knuckles. One dirty martini after another. His fingers in me, syrupy, astringent. And wait, wait, there it is. Briny. A blue-black wintry dawn crept up the squat roofs of Brooklyn when I left for my apartment. I was in the cab. The car was flying over the East River. The bridge woozy, the car weightless. I had a small mirror in my bathroom, but it was high and I couldn't see below my chin. I climbed up and curled myself into the sink bowl. There were marks. A bruise on my chest, above my breast, a nebulous thumbprint. Some chafing on my neck and chin. A red, hive-like oval on the inside of my arm. A cast of blue peeled down my bottom lip. Red dashes on the inside. My underwear felt wet, and I looked down. There was my period, days early, like he had pulled a trigger. My eyes cloudy from wine. The skin under my nose flaking from the radiator. I couldn't stop touching my face. The blank screen that everyone projected onto. Whatever beauty I had, it wasn't self-generated, wasn't rooted. It was permeable. But underneath that, I could just make it out. The face of a woman. It was my mouth that was changing. This bleak, purplish, inflated mouth. And my left eye perpetually smaller now, swollen. It didn't open as wide as it used to. Tired, is what a friend would say. I didn't look new anymore. I would get tattoos of the bruises. He would be surprised. What did he call his tattoos? A commitment to a moment? Look, Jake, my body is committed. I lay on my mattress, counting heartbeats. I knew it would never be repeated, that night. Never exactly like that again. Never as surprising and powerful again. And so I held it, without reviewing it. I held it perfectly still. The walls of my room turned milky with light. I listened to the last of the Puerto Ricans, rowdily clamoring home. Various snowstorms piled up like traffic, snowbanks grinding into sidewalks and rising like new buildings. And indoors, the soups kept coming. Cure-alls. Santos surreptitiously made menudo on Sunday mornings with a cast-off cow parts. The tripe was sweet, and the broth was oily. It tasted like iron, oregano, and limes. Sriracha on everything, even in emergency soups of chicken broth and scallions. Knots in our necks, flus, sinus infections. We passed the ailments between us. Will, Ariel, and I sat bowed over our bowls in silence while the beginnings of a storm hit 16th Street. Scott made pho for family meal, a recipe he got from an old man in a market stall in Hanoi. It was a gift, steaming, fragrant with star anise, rich. "You disappeared after the party," Will said to me. Ariel twirled her noodles. I slurped with my eyes down. "I just went home." "That's funny. You never usually just go home." "I was tired," I said. "How was home?" He sat back in his chair, arms crossed. "Was it nice?" "Yes, it was glorious." I went back to my bowl. When I looked up, he was injured, and I was ashamed. "Well, Can you act like my friend? He looked into his bowl.
I don't know.
He got up and left. I turned to Ariel, hoping for some sympathy. She was also absorbed in her soup.
It was amazing, I said quietly.
Gross.
I've never felt anything like it.
I usually have trouble.
Coming?
Well, yes. I mean, it's fine by myself, but hard at other times. With people. But this time it wasn't difficult.
Well, great. He's had a lot of practice.
Don't be mean.
I'm not, but you want me to act like great sex is the end of the world.
It is the end of the world, I thought.
No, but it feels big. I can't explain it. I feel womanly or something.
You think it's womanly to get fucked?
She had her clawed tones out, and I retreated.
I don't want to argue about gender theory. I just feel like something real happened, and I wanted someone to talk to about it, like a friend.
Let me guess,
she said, tapping the spoon against the tablecloth.
He beat you up a little bit, called you a slut, and you thought that was really edgy. Another spoiled white girl who wants to get slapped around because she always got everything she wanted.
Fuck, Ari. I shook my head. It must be hard to have already sized up the world, to already have written it off completely. Is it just so fucking boring all the time?
Pretty much, Skip.
I would rather be called a slut by him than deal with the shit I get from the women here. I picked up my bowl. Also, you're fucking white, by the way, and you don't get a medal for being gay.
Listen, she said, her voice calmer. She pouted out her bottom lip. I am looking out for you. Don't start measuring your life in sex. It's dangerous. Great sex is not a big deal.
I sat back down. What is a big deal, then?
Intimacy. Trust.
Okay, I said. Those words floated out above me. Abstract. Romantic. And I wondered what they looked like on the ground. Maybe they were already happening. Maybe they were embedded in the sex. Years of wondering if there was something wrong with me. Wondering why sex drove people insane. Years of mimicking porn stars, trying to arch my back in the most flattering way. Years of sex that was empty, never held its shape.
Isn't sex something?
She shrugged. I realized she had no idea what I was talking about. When we went to the dish station, I put my bowl down and hugged her from behind. I wondered how there was any room for the guests, with all of our hopeful faces and our imposing loneliness.
Let me try this again. It was changeover. He was coming in for the night, and I was the beverage runner from the day. It had been snowing on and off, spidery flakes brushing the windows, salt rims on the sidewalks, a tinctured light from a weak sun. I was making macchiatos, but really I was watching Enrique as he stood outside in a huge parka wiping down the windows. His gloved hands held a squeegee and pulled long draws of soapy water up the windows and opalescent patterns slid down. Jake stopped at the door to take off his cap and shake out his hair. When he touched his own cheeks from the cold, it was humbling. All of the most thoughtless gestures were exotic on him. Pulling his keys from his pocket for his front door, hanging those keys, with precision, on a hook inside his house. He looked different today. It wasn't as simple as us having been naked together. After all, it had been 2 a.m. and dark in his room, so I didn't know if that counted as actually having seen each other naked.